An immigrant detention center might be coming to the town of Dwight. The village president says it will bring hundreds of good jobs, but others don't like the idea of a detention center in their town. Plus, one in five Walgreens stores that were inspected by the FDA illegally sold tobacco products to minors. Is it time for the company to stop selling tobacco products altogether? And more than 30 years ago, Harold Washington became Chicago's first African-American mayor. We'll examine his legacy and how black politics have changed since.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, federal lawmakers are putting pressure on Walgreens to stop selling tobacco products. We'll explain why. We'll also be exploring the details of Governor Pritzker's progressive income tax proposal. Finally, we have details. And is it time for Chicagoans to stop chasing the ghost of Harold Washington? But first, the town of Dwight is not unlike many small towns in Illinois. That town's in between Bloomington and Joliet, and for years depended on one major employer for most of the jobs for its 4,000 residents. And then that employer left. A lot of you listening can relate to the idea of a single employer dominating a town. Just think of Caterpillar in Peoria or State Farm in Bloomington. The jobs in Dwight were coming from a prison, which is now closed. The village lost about 450 jobs and $50 million in annual economic impact. Community leaders believe they may have found a solution in the form of another kind of facility, an immigrant detention center, specifically a $20 million federal detention center for undocumented immigrants. Not everyone in the community supports this decision. The village board will be voting on this issue tonight, whether or not to approve the land for this use. Joining me for more on this from WGLT, our partner station, is WGLT reporter Eric Stock, who's been covering this. Also on the line from Macomb is Christopher Merritt from Western Illinois University's Institute of Rural Affairs. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Nala.
Thank you.
Eric, I wonder if we could just start with understanding when this proposal for an immigration detention facility first came to Dwight. Can you get a sense of how this became an option?
Well, according to Jared Anderson, who was the village president in Dwight, this company called Immigration Centers of America, based in Richmond, Virginia, had contacted them about 2 years ago about possibly locating this immigration detention facility in Dwight. Now, ICA is a private company, and it contracts with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security on running these detention centers. And it currently has one in Farmville, Virginia. And this has only been made public in the last few weeks as the village is starting to go through the formal process to try to make this happen.
So we invited Village Board President Jared Anderson to join us on the program today. He declined. Eric, you did have a chance to speak with him for your reporting for WGLT. Why did he say he wanted this for Dwight?
Well, first, for some background, Jared Anderson took over as village president in 2013 during what he said was a pretty difficult time in the village. It had just lost its top employer, as you had alluded to, the state prison, and was just starting to feel the effects of that. He had indicated that several businesses, some restaurants in particular, that had relied on that customer base and the good-paying jobs that came with it were struggling, and a few of them had closed. And he said the housing market also took a hit as families had to leave to find work elsewhere. And he says the village is just now starting to get back on firm ground and to see a housing recovery. And here is what he told us.
You're looking at $60,000 a year salary, so that's a good wage that would bring people into Dwight and give them an opportunity to, have a house in town. So we're close. I think I'm not going to say about face, but it would definitely be a positive injection into Dwight.
That's Dwight's Village Board President, Jared Anderson, speaking to WGLT's Eric Stock, who's with us now. So, Eric, is the proposal then that this former prison facility, that they would actually use that land for this detention center?
This would be a separate land, actually. It's just off I-55 on the northern tip of Livingston County. It's on 88 acres west of the interstate. The land is currently in unincorporated Livingston County, and that's why they're going through this process tonight. It is an annexation agreement that they would consider that would, along with it, enable the village to run infrastructure, water, sewer, etc. And it's our understanding that the village would be paying for those improvements for this facility to happen, should it happen, and the village would be paid for each detainee at the facility. That would offset the village's costs.
We're going to be joined from someone who opposes this ICE facility in a minute, but Christopher Merritt from Western Illinois University is also with us. And Chris, when we think about village leadership and Dwight describing how they feel like they don't have many options, I wonder if you can speak to, when it comes to the economic landscape of small towns when a major employer leaves, how many more options are there?
Yeah, that's a great question. We've seen in Illinois a lot of rural places have lost population, and as agriculture has become more productive, we need fewer farmers, and many of those great manufacturing jobs, of which rural Illinois has had many, we're also seeing them leave. And so this has been one of the economic development strategies that many rural communities have pursued, and that's to have a prison located, whether it's Rushville or Galesburg, for example, Pontiac, of course, just down I-55. And so it's absolutely makes sense, I suppose, from a on-the-ground Main Street economic development strategy. Prisons look like a good deal.
That's Christopher Merritt from Western Illinois University. We've also been speaking to WGLT reporter Eric Stock. And I wanted to welcome Sunny Garcia, a Bloomington Normal resident who started the No ICE Dwight Facebook campaign and has been working to mobilize members to attend Dwight Village Board meetings on this issue. He's also at WGLT. Hi, Sunny.
Hello.
So, Sunny, what made you want to start this No ICE Dwight page?
Well, I've been a longtime immigrant rights activist here in Central Illinois. And really on state, local, and federal level, trying to advocate for immigrant rights. And as soon as we got word that this detention center was being proposed for the village of Dwight, we immediately started working and activating and mobilizing our network of activists and advocates around the state.
So what is your biggest concern about having an immigration facility like the one that's been proposed for Dwight?
Our biggest concern is the private prison industry, and their bottom line is just to make profits. So cut corners wherever they can on wages. I know they're promising some really good wages, but the reality of it is that they pay minimum wage. They are anti-union. They try to bust up unions every time they can. And the majority of the work that's being done in the facility to maintain it is being run by forced labor, by the people that are detained there, who are paid at most a dollar a day.
So it sounds like it sounds like your objection is both economic and moral. Am I correct in understanding that, Sunny?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the people of Dwight are being promised a great job opportunity, but the reality of the situation is that the private prison industry, and especially immigration detention centers, are a boom-bust industry. So it really depends on who is the sitting president, what their policy is. It's going to directly affect the amount of detainees that are in that facility, and even whether or not it's going to be open. We don't know if it's going to be open in 2 years when a new administration comes into office in Washington.
Sunny, as you've been listening to us discuss some of the economic concerns that Dwight is facing, this isn't a town that you live in. I wonder what you might say to those who do live there, who see this as an opportunity to bring more money and jobs to Dwight and say they don't see other options.
Well, there are other options. We've presented options at the meetings that we've attended. There's a lot of new stuff on the forefront. Green New Deal is being proposed. That is something that should be sustainable for the long term and would employ thousands of people in the state of Illinois and millions across the country. So, I mean, you can look at the economics and see that it doesn't make sense, that it's a boom-bust industry, or you can try to look at other options that are going to be long term and, morally centered with the values of the people of Dwight.
Eric, I wonder if I could ask you about that. To Sonny's point about the values of people in Dwight, we've been talking about, Sonny's been talking about his objections to having a private prison industry complex organization, a company based in Dwight. But as we've been talking about, the Dwight Correctional System was there for 85 years. What do folks in Dwight say about having the prison there? Is that something that people have struggled with?
Well, it seems to me, in talking to Jared and getting a sense for what's going on in the community, given that that was a major employer and a major economic driver and had been around for so long, that it was simply viewed as part of the fabric of the community as much as anything else. And as he had told us, there were generations of families who had worked at that facility. So, you know, we all have different opinions about the criminal justice system and how effective it may be in deterring or preventing crime. But their standpoint seems to be that these prisons are going to be located somewhere. So they would take advantage of that if the opportunity had presented itself. And so I suspect that they may view it less from a political lens than maybe others do. That said, to the extent that this could be a political issue, Livingston County and Dwight have been Republican strongholds for generations. To illustrate, in the last general election in November, then-Governor Bruce Rounder, the Republican, defeated J.B. Pritzker, the Democrat, by a more than 2-to-1 margin. Of course, Rounder lost by double digits across the state. Now, that's not to say that all Livingston County supports the president's stance on immigration, but that might make them less sympathetic to those who are actively campaigning to stop what they view as a potential economic boom to the community.
Christopher Merritt's also with us from Western Illinois University. And Chris, I wanted to ask you just about that. I mean, you were, before talking about, certainly across Illinois, there are towns whose entire economy is based on having a prison. I imagine the politics of that may be different for towns where their livelihood depends on it, as Eric's saying.
That's true. Although, you know, I have to say I do see kind of a moral complexity here. The question we might ask, and I think the other guest pointed out, that, you know, what other options might be available. And, you know, when we had a state-run, government-run prison system, you know, I had a sense, or maybe there was a stronger sense at least, that the criminal justice system is being run, you know, primarily on, you know, the fair unfolding of justice, as opposed to a private sector bottom line motive. And, you know, there's examples of, you know, judges, you know, taking kickbacks, you know, from, you know, there's a case in Pennsylvania back in 2009 where a judge was taking kickbacks to unfairly imprison people going into a private detention center. And so it raises questions about when you have the private sector controlling the criminal justice system, to what extent are local communities concerned about it? Should they be concerned about it? At the 30,000-foot level, when we have lobbyists representing the private sector prisons, even affecting not just criminal justice policy, but one could even imagine immigration policy, you know, it may not just be about economic development in this instance.
And Chris, I wonder about that as well. We've been talking about, obviously, there's a difference between our criminal justice system and a prison and an immigrant detention facility. Do you think that adds a further layer of complexity to this?
Well, it does to me. And again, you know, I guess even another question I would ask is, you know, what's the morality of the point of rural communities, you know, having a narrow, or at least seemingly having a narrower set of economic development options? And so we can even go a step back further. You know, why aren't there more obvious choices for rural communities? And the idea that this is a detention center, well, I mean, I'm going to guess they've got guards. You know, it's a question of semantics, I suppose. I mean, you know, what's a prisoner and what's a detainee?
I was wondering, Sonny, I wonder if it makes a difference to you morally if we're thinking about someone who is a convicted criminal serving a prison sentence versus someone who is an immigrant who's being detained for being in this country illegally.
No, there is no difference. I mean, they're still incarcerated. They still cannot leave. It's morally reprehensible. And just to get back to the morality and the economic concerns of the village of Dwight, like I stated earlier, it's a boom-bust industry. There have been lots of complaints with this particular private prison. ICA has complaints from former workers who complaining about the working conditions. If you go to their webpage where they are rating them, there's like a 1.5 rating from ex-employees out of 5. And a lot of the times when push comes to shove and there are some lawsuits going on about wrongful deaths with having inaccessible Medicare or access to health care within the system, and the company is being sued. But if the company files for bankruptcy as a private prison, the village of Dwight is going to be stuck with that lawsuit. So that's something else that they need to consider.
Imagine something, Sonny, you'll say this evening at the meeting. I assume you're planning to attend, Sonny?
Yes, we will be there.
Eric, what's next? So there's this board vote this evening, then what happens?
Well, even if it is approved tonight, it is still not a done deal. The village board could okay the annexation, and then the Department of Homeland Security makes the final decision in whether to award the contract. So this merely would put Dwight in the running for this facility. Now, they may be further along, but that's not been made clear at this point. The company Immigration Centers of America had supposedly been scouting several other potential sites in other cities for this facility. So it would not necessarily be a done deal, even if the village board approves it tonight.
All right. Well, we'll have to follow the results of that vote this evening. We'll tell you what happens tomorrow on the 21st. Eric Stock will be covering it for WGLT. I want to thank him, along with Christopher Merritt, with the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University in Macomb, and Sonny Garcia for being with us. He's part of the No Ice Dwight campaign from Bloomington Normal. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Between the Buildings, Art from Chicago, highlighting CAM's collection of work by Chicago artists. Open now through March 23rd. More information at kam.illinois.edu.
Back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you look for Illinois companies on the Fortune 500 list, you see the most valuable one is Walgreens. The Deerfield-based company made $131.5 billion in sales last fiscal year. It's also at the top of another list, one that has made the company the target from both lawmakers and federal agencies. Last month, the FDA said publicly that Walgreens was the number one culprit when it comes to selling tobacco to minors. Commissioner Scott Gottlieb said that since 2010, nearly 1 in 5 inspected Walgreens stores have done this. 5 Democratic senators, including Dick Durbin, have also written to the Illinois company, calling on them to stop selling tobacco products altogether. For more on this, I'm joined by Lisa Schenker. She's a healthcare business reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Lisa. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thank you.
So, Lisa, I mentioned that number 1 in 5 inspected Walgreens stores have illegally sold tobacco products to minors. Where does Walgreens stand in this landscape of how, when we're thinking about illegal tobacco sales?
Well, basically, the FDA came out and said that Walgreens had the worst track record of all pharmacies that sold tobacco. There are a lot of other companies that also have had violations. The FDA has come out and said that other companies that had worse rates of violations than Walgreens include a lot of gas stations: Marathon, Exxon, Sunoco, BP, Mobil, Shell, Chevron. Although Walgreens did have a higher rate than like Walmart and Rite Aid.
And so, and has Walgreens been the top violator for a while now?
This is something that the FDA put out in the last week or so, and they said that this has been the rate since 2010. So it appears that they've been the worst violator among pharmacies for at least the last 8 or 9 years.
And so, Lisa, I think there's a couple of issues here. First, there's the issue of Walgreens employees violating the law by selling cigarettes to minors, right? And then I know Walgreens has said that the company will be more strict with employees who are not following the right procedure when it comes to carding people. But then there's the bigger question, right, of whether a company that's involved in healthcare should be selling cigarettes at all. And I wanted to ask you about that broader issue because last month, five senators, including Dick Durbin, sent a letter about this issue. What did they say?
They said that they would like to see Walgreens eliminate tobacco products from its stores. They said that Walgreens, they believe if Walgreens is going to put itself out there as a health and wellness company, that selling tobacco is not in line with that, and they're unhappy about the rate reported by the FDA of selling tobacco products to minors.
And did Walgreens respond to that letter?
Walgreens said in a statement to me when I asked them about it that they have a zero tolerance policy when it comes to prohibiting the sale of tobacco products to kids, and they're going to terminate anyone who violates that. And they also have a policy now where they require ID from anyone buying tobacco products, regardless of their age.
But to the broader point about stopping selling tobacco products, no response on that one, Lisa?
You know, in the recent past, they have stood by that policy. As recently as January, when they had their most recent annual stockholder meeting, executives defended the choice to continue selling these. They said, basically, it's up to customers. They want to give customers that choice, and they offer smoking cessation products for anyone who is trying to stop. Although they are kind of experimenting with the idea of taking tobacco out of stores, they have a program in some stores in Gainesville, Florida, a pilot program where they took tobacco products out of those stores, and they're seeing how that's going.
And when we think about this, one of Walgreens' biggest competitors, CVS, actually stopped selling cigarettes. It's five years ago, right, Lisa, since they stopped selling cigarettes?
I believe so.
So what caused CVS to make that change?
I think they were like one of the first big pharmacies to come out and say that we're not going to sell cigarettes anymore. And they got lauded for it. They got a lot of positive reaction, I think, from being the first, saying that they just didn't want to promote it anymore because it wasn't healthy.
And then I wonder just getting back to the issue of just the legality of this for selling cigarettes to minors, which is illegal. Are there legal consequences to that in terms of the FDA can say, look, Walgreens is the number one chain pharmacy when it comes to breaking the law. Are there legal consequences to it, though?
Sure. The FDA can impose fines and penalties. And they've already done so when it comes to at least one Walgreens store. There's a Walgreens store in Miami, and they barred that store from selling any tobacco products for 30 days because of violations there. So they certainly can take action.
Right. And I guess the bigger question, though, Lisa, is if Walgreens wants to become a bigger player in the healthcare industry, do you think continuing to sell tobacco products will be a problem for the company?
It's a good question, and I guess only time will tell. They've had shareholders pushing them, they've had groups of shareholders pushing them for years to stop selling these products. We're going to have to see how it plays out for them. I'm not sure how that would play out for them financially if they did stop selling them, and I kind of wonder if this pilot program in Florida, if they're watching that to see whether that would work more widely.
Mm-hmm. Right, to see the financial consequences of that. Well, that's Lisa Schenker. She's a healthcare business reporter with the Chicago Tribune. We will tweet out Lisa's reporting on this, a couple stories she's been doing over the past few weeks on this. Lisa, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's been more than three decades since Harold Washington made history by becoming Chicago's first African-American mayor. During his time in office, Washington became known for breaking the Democratic machine, advocating for civil rights, successfully harnessing Black and brown political power in the city. It's an example the Black community in Chicago has turned to time and again when trying to emulate that success. But it's been a long time since Harold Washington was mayor. And as Chicago selects its next leader, who will be African-American, is it time to give up the ghost of Harold Washington? Natalie Moore has been writing about this for WBEZ Chicago, and she's on the line with us now for more. Hi, Natalie. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Nyla.
So, Natalie, it's hard to go very far in Chicago without seeing the name Harold Washington. You think of the public library, Harold Washington College, there's the park, there's the cultural center. You were a kid when he was first elected. What do you remember most about that time?
I remember a certain electricity that was in the city. You would go places and see him or see him on TV, and he'd say things like, "You want Harold where you got Harold." You know, he was folksy and intellectual, and he was accessible. I remember seeing him at soul food restaurants in the neighborhood that I grew up in. I remember seeing him at my childhood park. And there wasn't anything particularly special or in terms of, you know, clout heavy in these neighborhoods. Like, that's just who he was.
What do you think other Black Chicagoans will most remember him for when they think about his tenure?
They'll remember the historic nature of his run. They remember that he was a reluctant candidate at first. He was someone who told the business community that wanted to support him that they needed to have so many new voter registrations to get him in the ring. They'll remember how he was able to get lakefront liberals and Latinos and the Black vote. And they will remember how much white resistance there was to him in City Hall.
Right. There's a famous council wars that
yes.
Folks of who know Chicago history. Natalie, can you tell us just a little bit about that when Harold Washington was in office, what that was like? Natalie? Looks like we have lost Natalie. Let's see if we can get her back here as we're talking about Harold Washington and his term, his tenure for mayor. We're talking about this actually because there's two Black female candidates who are running for mayor for Chicago now. And the election's just about 3 weeks away. Toni Preckwinkle and Lori Lightfoot are both running for office in Chicago. Natalie Moore has been covering this for WBEZ Chicago. We'll tweet out Natalie's blog piece that she just wrote about it as well. And it looks like we've got Natalie back here. Natalie, I just wanted to ask you, I'm not sure if you heard that last question, just about the problems between Mayor Washington and Chicago City Council. You were talking about that and how white city council members, we were calling it the council wars. Can you explain a little bit more about that for people who aren't familiar?
There were a block of white aldermen that saw themselves as a wall against Harold Washington and would block any sort of legislation that he wanted to push.
So then I think when we think about politicians and when we romanticize politicians, I think it often happens when their tenure ends abruptly, as was the case with Harold Washington. First of all, can you remind us about his death? I wonder, you wrote about this, what it was like when you heard that he had had a heart attack and died.
He died in 1987. He had been reelected. And I remember feeling sad in school. I was in sixth grade. The principal announced it over the intercom. I wrote about it in my journal. And my parents took me and my siblings to see his body lie in state at City Hall. And when I talk about the spirit of Harold Washington or, you know, saying that his legacy won't save us, that is not meant in disrespect of him. I think some elders see the headline and they just can't move past or hear what it is that I am saying. We are in a much different political era where we had two Black women emerge as the two top vote getters, and neither one of them got the Black vote. And his name is always invoked. You know, who's the next Harold? Are Black people going to have a consensus candidate? And I just think that magic of 1983 won't likely be repeated. And that's okay. We can learn lessons from him, but we don't have to try to replicate what was done back then.
And when we think about that, and that brings us to this current mayoral race, certainly I think just like Harold Washington, I think many people were surprised that the two African-American women ended up being the final candidates for mayor. Was that an accurate thing to say, Natalie, that most people were surprised by that?
Yeah, I do think that most people were surprised. Lori Lightfoot didn't win any Black wards on the South and West sides. Tony Preckwinkle won some, but the person who won the most was Willie Wilson. But it's also important, I think, to look at the rankings in those wards. So even wards that Willie Wilson won, Tony Preckwinkle came in second. Sometimes Lori Lightfoot came in second.
And with Willie Wilson, who's sort of a perennial candidate for mayor in Chicago, is his endorsement going to be important here when we think about who the next mayor of Chicago will be?
Willie Wilson has certainly positioned himself to be a kingmaker and had a press conference on Friday to endorse Lori Lightfoot. I don't think it's going to hurt her. She lives on the north side. That does not take away from her Blackness, but she hasn't had a base on the south side. Tony Preckwinkle was an alderman. She's obviously running Cook County government, and Willie Wilson has name recognition and is from the west side, lived there for many years and has businesses and is known for his generosity, and Lori Lightfoot doesn't have that direct connection, and I think Willie Wilson vouching for her may get her some votes.
But what do you think it's the way that the vote went, Natalie? I wonder if, I mean, obviously it was a big field. There were a lot of candidates, but I wonder what it says about the idea that Chicago needs to identify, you know, to use your term, a consensus Black candidate. Is that still something that needs to happen?
I don't think so, but I think the better question is which candidate is going to have Black interest in mind. And sometimes that can be a Black candidate. Sometimes it may not be a Black candidate. There are dire issues on the South and West sides related to disinvestment, education, public safety. And so the idea is really who is going to best address those issues. It was a crowded pool of 14 people, and even the top winners, the people who were in the runoff, they didn't get much of the vote. These numbers were very slim because you had so many people. And I think going forward, voters in Black wards need to have a specific ask from those candidates about what they want.
Natalie, I wonder what you think both candidates can learn from Harold Washington.
I do think that there's value in coalition building, and I don't think that we see as much Black and brown unity in this city as we could. There are different needs in the communities, but there are also a lot of similarities. And I think that Harold Washington was able to bring people together.
And I wonder, what do you think it means for the rest of Illinois, Natalie, that Chicago will have a Black mayor and a Black female mayor?
I think it's something to note. The one thing that I wonder is if Black women are going to be the Black woman who's in charge after April 2nd is going to take the heat for all of the problems and be expected to clean everything up very quickly, and what kind of extra scrutiny will be toward her. That's something that I wonder about, and if people are going to have some reluctance of a Black female as the face of the city.
In the face of the city, in a lot of ways, I mean, the mayor of Chicago is oftentimes, I mean, sometimes even better known than the governor of Illinois, right?
Yeah.
When we think about the state and representing the state. So I wonder, do you wonder about that as well?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, too. I think the whole country will be watching. And, you know, Illinois as a whole, even if you don't live in Chicago, there's a lot at stake, and there's a lot of issues that are intertwined between state and local government and how this mayor is going to work with the governor.
It's going to have an impact on everyone, no matter where they live. That's Natalie Moore, who covers the South Side for WBEZ Chicago, on the line from there now. We will tweet out Natalie's blog post that she just wrote about this issue. Natalie, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
For listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Throughout his campaign, Governor J.B. Pritzker said he wanted to change our state's income tax. Today, all of us pay 4.95%, no matter how much or little we make. The governor has said all along we need to change that and have higher earners pay more. Well, late last week, we finally got the details of Governor Pritzker's new income tax plan for Illinois.
This tax plan does ask people who are wealthier to pay more, but not unreasonably so. And it does give a tax break to 97% of people across the state of Illinois.
For more on this, I'm joined by Brian Mackey, State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio from the Capitol. Hi, Brian. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hello, Nyla. Good to be with you.
And joining us for the first time is Peter Hancock, who's a State House reporter for Capitol News Illinois. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, thanks for having me.
Peter, I wonder if you can explain Capitol News Illinois to us. You guys are pretty new, right?
Sure. We are a new news service. It's a project of the Illinois Press Foundation, which is kind of the charitable philanthropic arm of the Illinois Press Association. And the idea was that because there has been, actually not just in Illinois, but elsewhere, shrinking State House press corps, we decided to try and fill in the gap. So using its nonprofit business model where we are putting out news for all 440 member newspapers of the Press Association. That's both dailies and weeklies. So we've been going, I think just a little over a month now, and it's been very successful.
And we're happy to have you. It's always good to have more independent journalism happening in Springfield. I don't think anyone, well, some people might disagree with that, but I think the vast majority of our population wants more journalists there, and especially to look at issues like this. So I wonder if we can delve into this, the details. Brian, so you and I have spent many hours on this air talking about this income tax plan, but we didn't have details up until now. So let's just look at some of these tax rates. Starting with people who are making $250,000 a year or less, what would folks in that tax bracket, their income taxes look like under what Governor Pritzker has proposed?
Yeah, this is the long-awaited details for the tax plan that he's been talking about since he was a candidate almost 2 years ago when he announced his campaign. So looking at people who make less than $250,000, we heard in the clip Governor Pritzker said that 97% of Illinoisans would get a tax cut. That is who he's talking about. It would be a pretty modest tax cut for anyone in there. But basically, because it would be, if this is approved by the General Assembly and the voters at a referendum next year, this would be a graduated or progressive income tax, which means that you have different rates of taxation on different amounts of income. So the first $10,000 you earn would be at 4.75%. Then the next $90,000 of income you earn, up to $100,000, would be at 4.9%. And then finally, from $100,000 to $250,000 would be at the same rate we've had, 4.95%. So because of that, what's called a marginal tax rate, because of those different income levels, you'd see a very small tax cut in there. But, you know, for some people, a few hundred dollars a year is a few hundred dollars a year. And that could be something they may not feel on a weekly basis, but it adds up over time. And that is what the governor is able to hang his hat on for his political messaging, which is to say, look, 97% of Illinoisans will get a tax cut under his plan.
So that is accurate, him saying that 97% number, Brian.
Well, it's accurate based on the PowerPoint presentation that his office put out. We have not actually seen legislation, and I personally have not yet had a chance to independently crunch the numbers. So it's what he claims.
And Peter, so what about that other 3% then, which is the folks who are making $250,000 a year or more? How much would their taxes go up?
Well, those people would be paying significantly more in taxes. That income above, these are called marginal rates. So once you hit $250,001, that income up to $500,000 would be taxed at a whopping 7.75%. And then there's another incremental increase at $500,001 up to $1 million that would go to 7.85%. And then people with over $1 million a year in taxable income would be taxed at just under 8%, 7.95% actually. The governor says this is going to generate about $3.4 billion a year in additional revenue for the state. And I guess you can kind of, the Department of Revenue is able to go back and look at, say, last year's tax filers and say, if these rates had been in place at that time, it would have generated this amount of money. Whether or not that actually pans out to be true when it goes into effect, it's hard to tell. But somewhere in that neighborhood, which is about what he said is the ongoing structural deficit of the state. He says, if the state were to be paying all of its bills and meeting all of its pension obligations and catching up on unpaid bills, the structural deficit is about $3.2 billion a year. So if this is true, if these numbers pan out, then that would get the state basically into fiscal balance.
And Brian, does the math there, do you agree with that math in terms of what the governor is saying, that when we look at our structural deficits we have as a state, that is about the gap that we're at?
Well, I mean, that's, assuming that the economy continues growing at a reasonable pace and that we don't have another sort of moderate, it doesn't have to be the sort of cataclysmic Great Recession that we had 10 years ago that was so harmful to the fiscal fortunes of so many states. But even a modest recession would hurt this. You also have people who say that, this is going to cause rich people to either flee the state, which I have not seen great compelling evidence that that is something that is going to happen.
No matter what the income level, people don't really flee states, right?
Right. I mean, and the people who we have seen, the population declines we have had are not necessarily the people in the $1 million income brackets. We've seen a lot of lower income people, African Americans in the city of Chicago, for example, the numbers there have been declining a lot. College students going out of state, they're not paying a lot of taxes, but they are taking their tuition money to go to other states, partly because of the budget impasse. But to get back to your point, there's also this idea that rich people have ways of structuring their income, and if taxes get to be really onerous, they can play all kinds of games. I mean, there's a great incentive under this tax regime to earn $250,000 and not a penny more, right? Because that's where you start to see your tax rates going up. But ultimately, if you look at just income taxes, this is not, so out of line with what other states, even nearby.
That's what I was going to ask you about.
States.
Like, how does this? So some people might think 8% seems like a huge amount of tax rate for someone making more than $1 million. But is it when we think about even just other Midwestern states?
I haven't actually looked at all of the other states, but most states that do impose an income tax have a graduated structure similar to this. The rates go up as your income goes up, and the federal government uses a graduated or progressive tax structure. So it's not unfamiliar to a lot of people. Whether, the rates may be a little above or a little below other states. I'm one who doesn't believe that people move across the country or even move across state lines simply to avoid their state income tax burden.
Right. And I think most of the, at least when most of the research also bears out what you're saying, Peter. We're speaking with Pete. That's Peter Hancock, who's with the Capital News Illinois. Brian Mackey's with us as well. Go ahead, Brian.
I'm sorry to step on your reset there, as we say in public radio. But so I'm just looking. I happen to have in front of me the 2018 Illinois National Rankings book from the Illinois Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability.
Of course you do.
In the state of Iowa, for example, has a high tax rate of 8.98%, so one percentage point higher and change over what Governor Pritzker is proposing. Minnesota has a high rate of 9.85%, even higher. New York, it would be higher. California is up at over 12% for its high rate. Now, what critics of this will say is that we also have to factor in the other tax burden in Illinois. And certainly, Illinois does have one of the higher property tax regimes in the country. And they'll also say, look, we're not California. We don't have Silicon Valley. We're not New York, we don't have Wall Street, which is something that keeps people in those places. But you know, one of the other things that, you often hear from the business community is they want stability and predictability. And certainly from the standpoint of the credit rating agencies, which you know, have a role as a quasi-independent watchdogs over what state budgeting is, they want to see stability of revenue coming in. And that is the what Governor Pritzker says. This is something that would, you know, help Illinois finally begin to balance out a budget in a way that really hasn't been the case here since the dot-com bubble bursted in, whatever tense I want to use there, back in 2001.
And so when we think about this, Peter, let's just talk about, now that we have these details, how lawmakers are responding. Peter, let's start with Democrats. What are they saying about to support Governor Pritzker here?
Well, I think the Democrats are generally being supportive of the governor, and the Republicans, by and large, are just opposed to any sort of change in the tax structure. What I thought was kind of interesting is, you know, this takes a constitutional amendment. So it's unclear whether or not these specific numbers would be baked into that amendment, which makes it much more difficult to change in the future. I mean, right now, $250,000 a year is considered a lot of money. 20 years, 50 years from now, it may not be considered a lot of money. So it's unclear whether or not they want to pass a constitutional amendment that puts down specific numbers, or just an amendment that generally gives the state authority to levy a graduated income tax. You could, theoretically, just remove the sentence in the current Constitution that prohibits the state from enacting anything other than a flat tax. So it's unclear to me right now, because we haven't seen any drafts of a proposed constitutional amendment, whether or not this is simply the governor's idea as a starting point for discussion, or if this is what he actually wants to put into the Constitution.
And Peter, remind us, if there's a constitutional amendment, so that has to be something that has to be on a ballot, so that wouldn't happen until next year? November.
November of 2020. So, and then even if it passes, it would, the 2021 legislature would have to come in and enact that into statute. So you really, you wouldn't be seeing the additional money for a couple more years at least.
Brian?
Although you could imagine, I guess, where they would have sort of a legislation pre-filed that, or legislation passed that would say if the voters approve a constitutional amendment, then these rates would take effect. I would be surprised if the rates were baked into the Constitution. I mean, you hear there's a conservative advocacy group that's opposing this, that's you know, sort of demanding that. And we've heard businesses say, well, this is, you know, if you don't have that, well, then you're going to, I should say, you have business interests, like the Chamber of Commerce head was standing outside the governor's office for an impromptu news conference after the governor announced this last week. But they say if you don't specify these numbers, then you're giving the Democratic legislature a free hand. And so now Governor Pritzker can say, sure, 97% of people will get a tax cut, but there's no guarantee that that is what the actual rates would look like once they were passed into law, or that they couldn't be raised in the future.
Well, and that brings me to we just have about a minute left here, guys, but I wonder how much now we see sort of a campaign style commercials, information wars, if we have it, over how accurate this is. Like, how much messaging are we going to see from business interests or other folks who oppose this? Is this going to be, are we going to see a lot of commercials and people are going to start hearing a lot of radio ads about this stuff, Brian?
Oh, well, I mean, I can tell you, I know somebody already got a robocall over the weekend from a group identifying itself as Illinois Policy, which I'm not clear if that's the Illinois Policy Institute or Illinois Policy Action, their advocacy group, but basically saying, you know, press 1 to be connected with your local state representative to tell them you oppose the graduated income tax.
Yeah, I think you've already started seeing the campaign war begin. There are two large sort of dark money groups, Think Big Illinois, and the other is
Jobs or something.
And they both have considerable funds at their disposal. I think one of the big questions will be, how much political capital does the legislature as an institution have with the public? I mean, even if you put these numbers down on paper and say this is what we're going to do, are voters trusting enough of the legislature to follow through on their promise?
Well, we know you guys will be keeping an eye on this. Peter, as I said, happy to have more journalists in the Capitol. Peter Hancock is with Capitol News Illinois. Brian Mackey is with Illinois Public Radio. Thanks for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, Nala.
Thanks for having us.
That's all the time we have for today. You might remember last Thursday, a gunman named Floyd Brown shot and wounded his girlfriend and a sheriff's deputy inside a hotel in Rockford while he was being served with an arrest warrant. That sheriff, McHenry County Deputy Jacob Keltner, later died from that shooting. Brown was apprehended after a standoff with police on I-55. And just to update the story, this afternoon, Brown is scheduled to appear in federal court in Rockford. Federal authorities have charged him with first-degree murder. If convicted, he could face the death penalty. Stay tuned to this NPR station for more on that. That does it for us today. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information about us, past shows. If you want to leave us some feedback, send us a voicemail. Find us on social media. Just go to 21stshow.org. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you here tomorrow.